Again, it's really hard to imagine that a year ago we were all sitting here trying to prepare frantically for Pesach, trying to do workshops and kashering workshops and all these different things because everybody was staying home and no one really knew what was happening. And here we are a year later, and although we've experienced loss, of course, Baruch Hashem, our numbers continue to go down, and we are much more hopeful this Pesach and this Yontif than we are at all the other previous Yomim Tovim over this past year. So let's hope that this Pesach does bring a Geula and a Geula Shlema. But again, in the chat box, if you would like, are the Mar Makomos. They were emailed out as well, and we'll go through them. We're not going to read everything inside. Because you yelled at me a number of years ago that I didn't give you the entire, hold on one second, I didn't give you the whole actual Mar Makom, the whole actual source, so I've scanned them all here for you. So nobody gets upset. I don't want anybody to be upset. And we did the following. We'll start with, again, it's been a very difficult year in terms of the loss of Gedolim and the loss of rabbinic leaders that we've had over this past year since Pesach, last Pesach. And we'll go through some of their thoughts, and really not just their thoughts, but I think things that are a little bit more, symbolic of some of their teachings. So let's begin with Rabbi Sacks. Rabbi Sacks has, of course, a wonderful, wonderful Haggadah that is worth buying. Both with essays in the back and his own commentary throughout the Haggadah. And here I have a few suggestions and then a piece of his that is not in the Haggadah, but was actually printed in a YU Torah to Go a number of years ago that is worth reading. First, when it comes to the Arba Bat and the four sons. So Rabbi Sacks suggests that these four sons are not different people, but successive stages in the development of a child. The night of Pesach is a magical evening. That is perhaps one of the greatest shows of Chazal's vision that they understood what it means to be an educator. It's interactive, it's engaging, it's participatory. And he says that we begin with being unable to ask. We accept the world as given. The next stage is intellectual growth, is curiosity. That's a child with a simple datam. We ask questions with no ulterior motive. We simply want to learn. Rabbi Soloveitchik would often talk about the love of learning that a child has, the curiosity of a child. That's followed by a period of testing and challenging the values. That's the wicked child, the adolescent. The Hebrew word for na'ar means to shake off. The teenage years are where we develop our own identity, but putting our perceived values to the test. That can lead to rebellion as a form of self-exploration. This culmination of cognitive growth is wisdom, at which point we've internalized the values of our heritage and are sufficiently mature to see their objective merits. That means, although the Haggadah used the word wise, it means really a Talmud Chacham. So says Rabbi Sacks, the first piece is that the Arba Banim are the stages of each one of us. But this is a very important idea that we are not identifying, according to many commentators, you are the Rasha versus you are the Talmud Chacham, but rather they are part of who we are. Sometimes we're more curious, sometimes we're more jaded, and it might not even, to expand Rabbi Sacks a little bit more, it might not even be at stages of our lives, but different parts of who we are. Sometimes we are more like the Tam, sometimes we are more like the Rasha, sometimes we're more like the Shana de Elisha, and sometimes we're more like the Chacham. Rabbi Sacks continues that these four people are all different. One asks because he wants to know, one asks because he doesn't want to know. And he explains beautifully that this is a message of hope in this family portrait. Though they disagree, they sit around the same table, telling the same story. Though they differ, they stay together. They're part of a single family. Even the rebel is there. Although part of him does not want to be, this too is who we are. The Jews are an extended family. We argue, differ. And sometimes we are deeply divided. We are part of the same story. We share the same memories of difficult times. We can count on one another. I think Rabbi Sacks, to who he was as a person, was a great unifier of Jews, was a great ambassador of the Jewish people. And he understands that as we look back to this past year, which was, one of understanding that we might differ at times. And we've seen that over the past few months. We realize, as Pesach reminds us, that we all sit together around the table, that we all share in each other's, growth and each other's journey. And that's a very, very important piece of who we are. Okay. As we continue, I want to go to a piece from Rabbi Sacks that is, to me, one of the most unbelievable things that Rabbi Sacks can do is that Rabbi Sacks is able at times to give wonderful Musar, but in his own way. And because of who he was, we listened to it and we accepted it and it made sense to us. And we didn't like try to defend against it or attack it or respond to it, but it made sense because it was given in his very sweet and very, you know, straightforward mannerisms. And he explains that the Gemara Yerushalmi says what about the Rasha. The Rasha says, Mahavoda hazos lachem. But the Gemara Yerushalmi says, Ma toreach hazeh. What is that you are like, you're busy, you're putting all this work in. That's what the Gemara Yerushalmi says is the Rasha, right? He's saying, what's this avoda? Avoda means, what is this service? Meaning, why are you working so hard? Seems a lot of work that you're doing as a Jew. And to understand the Gemara Yerushalmi, he quotes the Pasuk, Vayavidu is Mitzrayim is b'nei so b'farach, Vayavidu. We served Paro. So the Rasha is saying, avoda there, avoda here, what's the difference? What's the difference? They're all the same avoda. You're all working hard. What's changed? Okay, so you went from Paro and now you have God. What's the difference? And Rabbi Sacks writes the following. He says, as I write, the Jewish world has been reflecting on the Pew report of American Jewry showing that outside Orthodoxy, the out marriage rate has risen to 71%. 32% of young Jews describe themselves of no religion. Less than a third of American Jews belong to a synagogue. 48% Cameron Hebrew. And he continues that we're going on to America. And he goes to the bottom paragraph. This is an amazing idea. He goes, let me suggest one explanation. Throughout a century of reflection on how to sustain Jewish identity in an open, secular society, the case has often been made that we need to make Judaism easier. Why make the barrier so high, the demand so steep, the law so rigorous and demanding? So one by one, we lowered them. Shabbos, Kashrus, conversion, were all made easier. Taras HaMishpacha, many circles outside Orthodoxy, they fell in, right? Done, forget about it. Put them in the drawer. The assumption was, the less demanding Judaism is to keep, the more the Jews will stay Jewish. Right? The more, the less demanding it is, the more the Jews will stay Jewish. And he says, the Gemara Yerushalmi is the answer to the Rasha. Why is it so hard? And he says, because that's what Judaism is. Judaism isn't easy. It takes work. It takes effort. He quotes the story that he would once ask, you know, non-affiliated Jews, what are your two most attended holidays? Pesach and Yom Kippur. These are the days, not Hanukkah, not Purim, not Shavuos, the easy ones, the two hardest ones. And he writes the following. Speaking personally, the answer that I would give to the Rasha when he says, why is it such hard work? My child, you ask a good question. I respect you honestly. You're telling it the way you see it. It's important that you speak your mind. I cannot give you an answer that will end your doubts, but I can say what I've learned in the course of my lifetime. People are prepared to undergo a long and arduous training to earn a living, to become a doctor, a lawyer, a therapist, an economist. Judaism asks us to undergo an equally long and arduous training in order to live, but not just to be a doctor or lawyer or therapist or economist, but a human being who is bigger than his or her specific roles. That's because Judaism takes the life, the art of living given in the image of God with absolute and ultimate seriousness. That Judaism is work, it's effort, it takes time. And every other area of life, Rabbi Sacks says, we work doubly as hard. We put in, we go to graduate school and we do professional development and we go to the gym and we do all of these things. But when it comes to Judaism, when it comes to our religious lives, we say, come on, God, why is it so hard? Why is it so much work? Can't it just be easy? That's the Rasha's question. Avoda azos lachem, so much work. And the answer is that we've tried to make Judaism easier and it didn't work. When we got rid of the laws of Shabbos, the laws of Kashrus, it didn't help. It didn't help. When we started the Shabbos Project a number of years ago, the Shabbos Project goal started by the Rabbi Warren Goldstein was not to just come for Friday night, but to experience all of Shabbos. It's not so easy, but it takes work, but it's meaningful. And that's the answer we give to the Rasha. The answer we give to the Rasha is Ma'avoda hazos lachem, because this is what we do. And he says at the bottom, that's what Pesach is about. Pesach is about my, it's about my personal experience of freedom. On Pesach, we must see ourselves that we personally left Egypt, but it's also about our shared experience of freedom as we tell the story and hand it to future generations. Judaism is about the I and the we. Without our willingness to encourage questions, argument, debate, and endless new interpretations, we lose the I. Without halacha, the code that binds us across centuries and continents, we lose the we. If anybody else but Rabbi Sacks says this, we'd, oh my gosh, this is Rabbi Sacks. He spoke truth to what is failing in some of our circles. And that is an adherence to halacha, an understanding. Why do we think that Pesach, out of all the Yomim Tovim, has the most laws? So many laws go into Pesach. Bedigas chametz, beer chametz, carbon Pesach. This year, you know, last 2 weeks ago on Shabbos, we discussed what's going to happen this year and every Pesach that falls on it. All the laws, I got to wash early, I got to go, I got to do all of these things. And we discussed the fact that if in any year I can start the Seder by saying, look how many laws I did today, God. I woke up early, I had two meals, I ate the egg matzah, I didn't eat the egg matzah, I had the rolls, whatever you did, whatever you do is probably right. Just don't have bread on every Pesach, like in the afternoon, then you'll be fine. But Pesach is about halacha. Halacha is what keeps me committed to God. It puts its work, its effort. It takes time. But the more that I do it, the more that I get reward. He quotes in this article, you can click on the link, a number of studies, Don Ariely and others, about when I do something for myself, I get more enjoyment out of it. That is not, you don't need a lot of studies to prove that, but he proves it. And that's what Ma'avodah Hazos Lachem. So that's Rabbi Sacks. And I think, at least in my mind, one of the things Rabbi Sacks is able to do is he's able to say things in such a straightforward and simple way, things that are so important to who we are as Jews, not just globally and, you know, an Or Lagoyim, but what's my identity as a Jew? Rabbi Sacks writes often about his personal journey to get to where he was and what that entailed. And it's important that we understand that as well. Okay, as we continue on, so we learned a few people, there's a lot more to learn from Rabbi Sacks. Let's go to Rabbi Lamb. Rabbi Lamb, in a similar vein to, and it's difficult, we could give a history lesson and what each one of these rabbis offered and how they helped shape who we are today as a people, as a centrist orthodoxy, but we don't want to take too much time. But Rabbi Lamb, like what we just mentioned, Rabbi Sacks, Rabbi Lamb did the same thing. If you look at Rabbi Lamb's sermons, his drashos, from his time as a pulpit rabbi, from his, you know, his shiurim, time as president of Yeshiva University, it is with a tremendous amount of mussar, of saying, this is where we have to get better as Jews. And he was not afraid to talk honestly about where our failings were and where we have to get better. It's shocking. Some of the drashos that I read of Rabbi Lamb, I'm in awe, first of all, of his he was a master darshan. He was a master darshan. You know, when I was in Smicha, you know, Rabbi Penner used to tell us you could take anything and turn it into a drasha. Anything you could turn into a drasha. And I used to be like, no way. But when you're a master darshan, you could do that. Rabbi Lamb was a master darshan. Anything could be not just a drasha, but woven with halacha and chasidus and kabbalah and modern day applications and historical knowledge and secular knowledge, all woven into an unbelievable, you know, tapestry of Torah. Besides that, Rabbi Lamb as well was a massive, massive Talmid Chacham. I had this chus of being in YU when Rabbi Lamb was still gave a few shir klalis, it's called. The president would give like a huge shir in the Beis Medrash, whatever Masechta the yeshiva was learning, and to learn from him and to see just his his knowledge in all areas was simply amazing. So he talks here. We'll do a few pieces. But for example, when it comes to we talk about Bavor Zeh. So he says here in this piece on the page number, if you have it, page number 5, that tradition assumes meaning and significance when it's transformed into halacha. When we participate in the tradition, not only because of its historical value, not only because of its sentiment, but because this is our response to the living God in Israel. It's the way we sanctify ordinary life, the way I discover significance in the trivial details of life and elevate them. That's our tradition. that Rabbi Lam is suggesting that when we, you know, celebrate Pesach in a way in which we're doing it with so many halachos, it is that's the way that we connect. That tradition, he says, is not a way of commemorating the past, but using the past as a pretext for living in the present meaningfully. And if you continue to the next piece, actually, there's two people. We'll do two pieces. He shares this in two ways. One is the way that he looks at maror. So he says the following. He says, maror that we eat at the Seder is more than a vegetable recalling the hard times inflicted upon the remote ancestors in ancient Egypt. Right? It is the very symbol of human anguish throughout the ages. And what we do with the maror is an expression of Jewish philosophy of suffering. He says, consider how astounding is our attitude towards this piece of food. Now it speaks volumes to us. We do not weep when we eat it. We take the maror, this morsel of misery, right? We're sad. We don't lean for maror. We recite a bracha over it as if to say, thank you, God, for this miserable memory. We take this herb and dip it into the charoses, which is the sweet taste of wine and nuts and fruits. Life, we say, in effect, is neither all bitter nor all sweet. With rare exception, it's bittersweet. I shared with Pesach Shabbos that almost everything we do at the Seder is bittersweet. Matzah is happy and sad. Charoses is happy and sad. Maror is happy and sad. The wine is happy and sad. And ever since Adam and Chava ate of the Eitz Hadas, our Kabbalists taught us good and evil are commingled, and life offers us neither pure, unadulterated goodness nor pure, unredeemable wickedness. The pessimist deplores the bitter and the bad that corrupts the sweet and the good. The optimist is delighted that the sharp edge of the bitterness is softened with the sweetness. That's why when the Jew, the eternal optimist, dips his mar into the charoses, he makes a bracha. And that's why he says it's Zman Cheruseinu. Right? Zman Cheruseinu is to understand that it's both together. He says, the last paragraph, the message of the mar is more than just the awareness of the bittersweet taste of life, not just the idea that every black cloud has a silver lining. What mar wants to tell us, this is important, meaning it's not to say, well, it was really bad, but I got something good out of it. What Maru wants to tell us is that misery is not meaningless, that pain is not pointless punishment, that human anguish has larger dimensions than the bitter leads to the sweet. Meaning there are two ways to view bitterness. Either it's terrible, why? But it got me to this point of, you know, recognizing something. So thank God for that because I came to this realization. Or even the bad somehow has meaning to it in and of itself. Somehow the charoses, right? That we dip the mar into the charoses because it's both mixed together. That is an extremely valuable, especially as we look back to this past year. We don't always understand and we have questions about it and we wonder and we're confused. But we don't only believe that bad just leads us to some better outcome. That somehow the bad is part of life. It participates in who we are in our journey. And then one more piece from Rabbi Lam. Again, there's so many more, but I tried to find pieces that, to me, at least in my very, very humble, and b'mechilas kvod, these great gedolim, I am not in any way trying to say that these are the pieces. But on the Haggadah, I found, to me, these resonated very much to me. And here Rabbi Lam talks about the Torah. Here Rabbi Lam talks about the Torah, just like Rabbi Sachs talked about the Torah. And when we say, Nasan lanu es haTorah, so we know, he says, the Mechilta tells us that all the other nations were offered the Torah, and of course they all rejected it. But just look at the last paragraph. He says, during the last many years, traditional Judaism in the Western world has expended much effort to prove that we are not really that different from others, that we can and do acculturate and adjust and speak the language and culture idiom of the Western civilization. That is as it should be. Had we not done so, we'd have lost much than we did. Yet we must not neglect our original and main function to offer an alternative to the world. Meaning, the goal of Torah is not to make us seem like everybody else. Torah is our guide. Rabbi Lam mentions this a number of times in his Haggadah. Torah is our guide. And as the world becomes, you know, even more extreme, Torah is even more of an anchor in everything that we do. Torah is our basis for everything. Rabbi Lam might be, you know, one of the faces of centrist orthodoxy, but that in no way took away from the value that Torah placed. If anything, it put it more at the center. That because I might be more into the Western world means that I need more of Torah to fortify me, more of Torah to secure me in who I am, not any less. Nor of Aaron Lichtenstein's Echatzal Levracha was in that same camp. They believed very much in being in that centrist world and being out there, but that took away nothing of the role that Torah has. If anything, it added more meaning that Torah has to take. And we must speak the authentic world of Torah to the great issues of our day fearlessly, courageously, and honestly. The Torah must guide us in everything that we do. Okay. We'll continue. Another great rabbi, another great leader who passed away over the summer, right around the time that Rabbi Lamb passed away, was Rabbi Steinsaltz. And Rabbi Steinsaltz was an author of over 80 books, a publishing company, an educational company, who never stopped working. Translated the Gemara, made Gemara learning accessible before art school, you know, took it to the next level, who really literally wrote his own commentary on the Gemara. Like a Rashi, if you open up a Steinsaltz Gemara, the thin brown little volumes of Gemara, my father used to learn them all the time, the Steinsaltz, he has the Gemara, he had Rashi, and he had his own commentary to help people understand Gemara. He wrote books on Kabbalah, he has a Chumash, so many books. And Rav Steinsaltz talks about, this is not necessarily on the Haggadah, it's on a, you know, text on the Haggadah, but like many of the Divrei Torah that we've shared over the years, the goal of our Divrei Torah is not to give gematrias and to tell you that this equals that, which is nice, but these are themes. These are things that we could talk about and discuss. As I tell my students all the time, it's okay to share Divrei Torah on the Haggadah at a lunch meal. No, it's okay if it's after the Seder also. If it's on the seventh day of Pesach, sharing Torah at any time is a good thing. So here Rabbi Rav Steinsaltz contrasts what does a slave versus what does it mean to be free. And he essentially says, well, hold on a second. Is being free mean I'm just not a slave? Or is not being a slave, does that not make me free? We would think that if somebody is a slave and he's now no longer a slave, well, then by definition, he's a free person. Says Rabbi Steinsaltz, that's not true. On the Seder night, we're confronted with a wealth of forms, symbols, rituals, customs. Right? At the root of all this variety lies one central idea behind the Seder's disparate parts into a single whole. Once we were slaves, and now we're free. But what does it mean? He says, the night of Pesach, the idea of freedom is given full expression in the Haggadah. And he says in the third paragraph here that freedom and slavery appear to be simple opposites, each defined in the absence of the other. Slavery, the absence of freedom, and freedom, the absence of slavery. But each of those terms must be understood without reference to the other. Throwing off one's fetters does not necessarily mean that one's entered into a state of freedom. Slavery is that condition in which a person is always subject to the will of another. Freedom is to act and carry out one's independent will. Meaning, nobody would argue that as a Jew, I'm free. I can't do whatever I want. I have laws. I have halacha. We just talked about halacha. If I ate fleishiks tonight and I want to go have, you know, milkshakes, I can't. I mean, I could, but there is a law that tells me I can't. If I want to eat a Yom Kippur, there's a law that says that I can't. So how is that free? How am I free? To achieve true redemption, and not only to an exile, it's not enough for the Jews to leave the wilderness of the nations and must regain its own essence, character, spirit, ways of thinking, and then it can be free. Through the laws, the customs of the Seder nights, what we are really emphasizing is the most important thing about ourselves. Once we were slaves, and now we are free, and we go through the rituals and recite the Haggadah. And to do that, to achieve redemption, we had to become this Am Segula. When we left Egypt, God says, you were a master to Paro, your Paro was your master, but now I'm your master. We're free in the sense that we get to worship HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But we're not free that we can do what we want. That halacha is telling me what I can do. It's how I worship God. So we have to redefine what it means to be free. And when we do that, when we realize, as he writes, in order to achieve true redemption, not only an end to exile. I'm sorry, we copied this twice. Here we go. We must bring ourselves to understand even more deeply than we shall truly be redeemed only when we take upon ourselves to fulfill our need to live in our own unique way. When I decide that I want that relationship with God, when I decide that I want to be more careful with mitzvos and daven harder and be more involved in Limud HaTorah, and that's freedom, because I'm choosing to worship HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's like ironic. The more that I do, the freer I become. Right? The more that I engage him in this process, the more of a ben chorin I become in a relationship with God. Okay. Moving on a little bit. I want to thank my father-in-law. I could not find this Haggadah that I thought I had from AMJ Turisky. My father-in-law was nice enough to send me some of the pages. So I want to thank my father-in-law. Here, Rabbi Abraham J. Twersky, really, what we talked about in our shir a few weeks ago, you know, not only a gem of a person, but what one of the, you know, rabbis and doctors to normalize mental health and depression and so many other areas that are today becoming more of the norm, and really was his, you know, instigating this whole, you know, movement. And to that, we are forever, you know, grateful to Rabbi Twersky, besides his number of svarim and books and articles. And he says that the four questions, the Manishtana, emphasize another aspect of spirituality, the ability to live with conflict. The emphasis of modern psychology on the resolution of contention has resulted in people eschewing conflict. Living with ongoing stress has become unthinkable. And many individuals who find themselves entangled in struggles that are not readily resolvable may attempt to escape therefrom by rather desperate methods, not the least of which is seeking the oblivion of alcohol, substances, or diversionary activities. Meaning, it's too much. I gotta get out of this stress. The loss of tolerance of conflict has had a profound impact on interpersonal relationships as well as the interpersonal psyche. The unprecedented divorce rate is to a great measure due to the inability to withstand conflict and to seek immediate relief from all frustrating situations. So if I'm in a conflict with somebody, it's one of the reasons that in the last 10 to 15 years, pre-marriage therapy, pre-marriage counseling that is recommended in both the Jewish and the non-Jewish world has risen by a large percentage. Because how do you live with conflict? The four questions that point out the Seder, the feast of spirituality, is characterized by this coexistence. We eat the dry matzah, the bread of the slave, the bitter herbs, yet I'm reclining, right? I'm happy. In fact, we, you know, when it comes to leaning at the Seder, we talked about the fact that according to one opinion in the Gemara, maybe I should lean only in the last two cups, but not the first two cups. The first two cups were still slaves. The last two cups, we were redeemed. So we know halacha, in the end of the day, we lean for all the cups. The point is that it's not contradictory to lean and also be sad. The answer is, says Rabbi Twersky, we don't have to reconcile all of our conflicts. The concept of freedom as espoused in the Torah is quite distinct from the secular concept. According to the latter, the ultimate aim of freedom is the absence of all discord, a state of rarely encountered in reality. Torah freedom includes the capacity to live with stress, to be able to achieve serenity in the face of conflict. One of the issues we see in the world of social media, for example, is that people think that social media is one of the reasons it increases stress and anxiety, is because as we stroll through people's pictures and timelines and stories and things like that, we get the sense that everybody else is living a stress-free life. Vacations, trips, restaurants, and here I am, leftover hamburger meat in my dining room table, and they're going out to eat after their vacation, after their trip, and it creates levels of stress. And the realization is that everybody has conflict. We like to get away from it. We like to run away from it and escape somewhere else, which is okay at times. But overall, the Torah's view is that you can live with conflict. That's what Rabbi Lam said earlier. The Mar and the Charoses. The matzah is lechem oni, and the matzah is as the bread of geula. It's both. We live with conflict. We live with both of these at the same time. I'll share one more piece from Rabbi Twersky. Rabbi Twersky here suggests, again, using his modern psychology approach, when we say matzah or marer, munachem lefanecha. So again, I wanted to share based on the same theme we developed earlier. Some say, granted, the message of the Exodus is the most important, but why must we have all the intricate Passover restrictions and the complicated rituals? Is it not sufficient to set time aside to meditate about the meaning of the Exodus? It's a great question. Why can't I sit down at the Seder, take out a book, take out the Chumash, and just sit back? Let's talk. Let's just talk about it. We'll read a book. We'll act it out a little. Why do I have to have so much order? You know, one of the most unique things about the Seder is that the Seder, at the same time that it's very orderly, which is what the Seder is, Kadesh Urchatz Karpaz Yachatz through Nirtza, this is how you're going to celebrate. At the same time, it's supposed to create emotions within us. One of the reasons we don't make a bracha on Sipur Yitzias Mitzrayim. So if you're taking notes, this could be another Haggadah Dvar Torah. You can get points at the table. If there's money given out, I do ask 10%. But again, that's to your own discretion. Why don't we make a bracha? There is a mitzvah the night of the Seder to tell the story. Sipur Yitzias Mitzrayim. It's mitzvah d'araisa. Why don't we make a bracha? We can make a bracha on everything else. So one of the answers is, it's a bracha shebelev. It just comes from my heart. If anything, it's like, I'm overflowing with emotion. So at the same time that I have an orderly way of how I'm going to celebrate, I also have this expression of individuality. That's why the Seder night is amazing. Because one of the things we struggle with as Jews is, how do I find my pocket of individuality and excitement and, you know, unique relationship with God when we're all doing the same thing? We're all saying the same Shemona Esrei. We're all saying the same benching. Where's my role? Where's Leap Tag's, you know, relationship with God? And the Seder night does that. Everybody's going to go in the same way, but everybody's going to experience it differently. So says Rabbi Twersky, why can't we just talk, meditate? Modern psychology has provided an answer to this question. In earlier times, it was thought that the approach to solving a behavioral or emotional problem was to analyze it carefully so that one could obtain insight into the origin of the problem, how it developed, what particular meaning the symptom had for an individual. The insight was supposed to resolve that problem and eliminate the symptom. The only trouble was that it frequently does not work. Patients are likely to say, "Doctor, I understand everything thoroughly, but I don't feel any different." Modern psychology has taken a different approach. Change behavior and insights will eventually follow. I can tell you this is true. You know, I'm not a therapist, and if you need a really good psychiatrist, I could recommend one for you and a psychologist. But as a teacher and as an educator in the classroom, this is absolutely true, that sometimes when you change the behavior of a student and how they're acting and how they're performing, some of the other symptoms go away. And you have to work on that behavior the same way that we work on all kinds of behavior. We work on everything else. We have to improve our behavior. So it says there by Twersky, merely meditating on the meaning of Exodus may indeed result in attaining intellectual insight, but this may not contribute much to spiritual growth. I might eat the matzah, the bread of affliction, which was the mains of our ancestors, because it was the cheapest thing available to fill their stomachs. One must eat the bitter herbs and taste the bitterness to identify the bitterness of the oppression. These symbolic acts may sufficiently reinforce the message of Exodus, and so that it has an impact on how we feel and how we behave. And he writes the end, spirituality is more readily achieved by behavior than thought. And I cannot tell you that line should be a bumper sticker on every single one of our cars and on our fridges, that spirituality is readily achieved by spiritual behavior than by spiritual thought. And that means that there's push over the last many years that we're to move away from some of the actions of Judaism more into the area of thought. We need to understand more of the whys, and which is thought very important, but it should not come at the expense of some of the whats of what we do. The more that I am engaged, the more that I am a machben in halacha, the more that I do, the more spiritual I become. And if I just try becoming spiritual through thought and meditation without action, it doesn't have the same substantive, you know, foundation to it than it does when I'm more involved in the actions. So the more that I do, you know, there are so many, the more brachos that I make, the more spiritual I become. Every single bracha I made today didn't make me so spirit. Yeah, but every bracha connected me. Every bracha reminded me that God was, I have to ask God for this food. Did I spend an hour on my bracha before coffee? I did not. Do I remember how spiritually uplifting that bracha was? No, but it connect. But many brachos that we make during the day connect us. This is extremely important. The night of Pesach is a reminder that actions. The Sefer HaChinuch tells us, "Achrei ha'pu'ulos nimshach halevavos," that our hearts are drawn after our actions. So on the night of Pesach, Shabbos HaGadol is going to be on Emunah. I mean, at least I think that's what Shabbos HaGadol is on, but there's a lot of time between now and then. But the more that I am involved, the more that I am engaged, the more that I do, the better I become as a person, the more closer I become to God and the closer I am my relationship with Him. Okay. Moving on to Rabbi David Feinstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, the great Posek Hador, of course, the son of Moshe Feinstein. You know, we told stories, a number of months ago about Rav David Feinstein, but whose area of halacha was only, the only thing greater was his personality, was his, warmth, his sensitivity, his care for every single Jew, his not wanting to meddle into people's other areas, perhaps of psak halacha, yet he was a posek hador. But here, I just want to, you can read more of this on your own. But he talks here about what does it mean to be free, about karpas. I'll share something very interesting that my father-in-law pointed out to me. I actually had a discussion about this today in my class about karpas. So Rav David Feinstein has a beautiful agada. But here he talks about karpas. So most people, I believe, when I took a poll one year, we did this. Most people, I think, use celery or something green. And some use potatoes. Cucumbers or other things. So he says, why potatoes? If it has to be something green, like yerek, why do people use potatoes? So he writes, because potatoes were just available. That was it. That was the easiest food to get. The easiest food in Russia was a potato, right? No other vegetable they had at the Pesach time. So perhaps the reason potatoes became a minhag was because that's just what people had at their tables. And in fact, one of my students says, this is what he does. And in fact, it's proven that family minhag was, that's all they had. So the minhag became to use potatoes. And, it's worth reading that piece, that piece on your own from Rabbi David Feinstein. I want to transition because I want to, bridge this week to next week. So I don't only want to talk about Rabbanim who passed away, but over this past year, we've had a number of Rabbanim who, who have helped us immeasurably as they do all the time. And that includes, which we'll talk next week, Rabbi Willig and Rav Shechter Shlita, people who are gedolim, who are always shepherding the Jewish people and carrying the weight on their shoulders in terms of shilohs and questions from around the world. And for sure, during Corona, it was clearly evident to our community how invaluable these gedolim were. And one of those gedolim was Rabbi Rimon. Rabbi Rimon is a beautiful, beautiful agada. And one of the pieces he says, in terms of something that's very applicable to our lives, is we know that the Jews in the Torah and the pasuk says in Va'ira they couldn't listen to Moshe. Lo shama la Moshe mikol tzeruach umeavoda kasha. They couldn't listen. Shortness of breath and a lot of work. So we quote here from his Rebbe Rav Aaron Lichtenstein zechutal livracha, and he says that at first blush the Torah seems to answer this and describes they didn't want to listen because of shortness of breath, but it's surprising. True that a nation found itself in a difficult straits, but why couldn't they? What was this? What happened? So there's two explanations. Shortness of breath and hard labor can be interpreted according to its simple meaning. They were exhausted. So the Mesilas Yesharim says. But in the second one here, where it says B, it's possible the nation was able to hear Moshe, but not the time that he had set out. The people wanted immediate redemption. We're not interested in long-term solutions. I will take you out. I will save you. That's why the people found it difficult to listen. Thousands of years have passed since that time. There's still great significance in these words. It's important to recognize the difficulty in listening to ideological long-term messages when one is in the situation of shortness of breath. That means that we live in a world in which we are running at a million miles an hour. We are so fast in everything that we are doing. We don't take the time to stop. And if anything, thinking about long-term religious growth is like completely 180 from what's happening in the world. If I can't see results today, right? Look around the world. If I want music, I want it now. I want my playlist and I want it automatically. I'll pay the $3.99 premium on Spotify because I don't want commercials and I want to choose my song. I want to lose 50 pounds in the next 3 days. I want to exercise as fast as I can and lose the most amount of weight. And yet when it comes to religious goals, it's the opposite. Time, effort, as we mentioned earlier, ma'avoda hazos lachem. And Pesach night reminds us that we need time, that we need time. And in fact, the Jews left b'chipazon very fast, but they also had to learn to slow down a little bit. They had to learn that growth is going to come in stages. We'll do this last piece from Rabbi Soloveitchik, and then we will continue this Amir Tashem next week with part two. Some new Haggadah, some new ideas, Amir Tashem. But I thought that looking to throughout the last year into sort of the ups and downs in this year that will go down, not only in history of the world, but in our communal history as one of the most unique and difficult and challenging but opportunistic years we've ever experienced. So he says about the story in Bnei Brak. He says that the Magidim have a beautiful interpretation. They say this refers to the Pesach at the outbreak of the Bar Kokhba revolt. They would talk of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Right? But he says, we know that these rabbis in the second paragraph, they did not belong to the same generation. Rabbi Akiva was younger than Rabbi Tarfon. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was younger than Rabbi Akiva. The passage tells us how the sages of Israel were concerned with one problem. One problem. How to transmit Torah from one generation to the next. So this round table, so to speak, was old and young, but they were united. The story of Exodus is a story of the Torah, of the whole night. Not the night of Pesach, but exile. It was a very long night in which they had to face Roman detectives, investigators, executioners. It was only after these five named sages to participate in the dialogue, after Akiva was executed and Relezer and Yeshua died, another generation. And it continued and it continued. And he says the following. The last paragraph. This is the central story of our destiny. We have survived. We are now building land of Israel. The key to the riddle of how we survive, the solution is to read the Haggadah for thousands of years, which is one, right? We mentioned here only one day, one generation. We're continuing it now while waiting impatiently for daybreak. We shall continue to narrate the story of Exodus, the tale of all tales, the Sipur, which never becomes obsolete. You know, I think as we look back towards this past year, and that's why part one of this is more like looking back towards last year. But as we look back towards last year and we looked at the Shilohs and all of these things that have happened, all these questions and all the ways that we followed halacha in ways we never had to imagine before, showed us that's how we tell the story. That we've told this story of how to pass on the Mesorah from one generation to the next. That when you know, already they're being published, but when the stories and the Shilohs are published from this past year, we'll say that we lived this story in Bnei Brak of how to pass the Mesorah from one generation to the next.